This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. Today on the show, there are concerns that a new free trade deal between tiny Pacific nations and Australia and New Zealand will exacerbate the region's non-communicable disease crisis.
The concern for those of us in public health would be that the undesirable, unhealthy goods would get freely imported into the islands.
That story coming up in around 10 minutes. And a huge mural of an Indigenous Chamorro man from Guam has been painted in Melbourne's city centre as part of an effort to revitalise the city after the devastating impact of coronavirus lockdowns.
My brain just exploded.
I was just like super, super stoked, you know, like, oh my God, like this is insane.
You'll hear from the man behind the mural coming up in around 35 minutes. But first, there are growing calls for Fiji's Attorney General to stand down from office in the wake of bombing allegations.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Fiji's Attorney General is a man who wears many hats and wields extensive power in government. Some even refer to him as the de facto Prime Minister. But there are now growing calls for Ayaz Sayed Kayum to stand down from his ministerial roles while police investigate two bombings, which he's accused of being involved in 33 years ago. Ayaz Sayed Kayum gave a statement to police this week, almost 5 months after the complaint against him was lodged. But as Attorney General loses popularity among some voters, questions have been raised about what this will mean for Fiji's government. Marion Farr reports.
In Fiji, they call him Minister A to Z.
He's well known to be the key power broker in that government.
Ayaz Sayed Kayum is not only the Attorney General, he's also the Minister for Justice, Economy, Communication, Anti-Corruption and a number of other portfolios. Political expert Dr. John Frankel says it's hard to overstate Mr. Sayed Kayum's power in Fiji.
He's the de facto Prime Minister. He's not got the Prime Ministerial title, but he has been the key person in Fiji politics. There's a separate Minister of Police, there's separate commands here, but Ayaz has been incredibly influential in handling law and justice issues and policing issues over the years since January 2006.
But now there are growing calls for Mr. Sayed Kayum to stand down from office while police investigate allegations he was the perpetrator in two cold case bombings 33 years ago. The complainant is Veronica Milani, the daughter of former Education Minister Ratu Filimone Ralongaval, who claimed she saw Mr. Sayed Kayum throw a homemade bomb into the driveway of her family home in 1987 when she was 14 years old.
Bruce Mingus reading ABC National News. There's been a dramatic new development in the crisis in Fiji, where the military took power in a coup just 2 days ago. The country's deposed Prime Minister, Dr. Timothy Bavanda.
It was the aftermath of Fiji's military coups that year, when Major General Sitiveni Rambuka took control of the government, declaring the move was to stop Fiji's Indian community from taking over politically. It's alleged Mr. Sayed Kayum was part of an Indo-Fijian pro-democracy group.
The Fiji Times said the military action had torn the heart out of the nation.
In a statement given to police in July this year, Ms. Milani says she and her mother were both seriously injured in the blast. Mr. Sayed Kayum is also accused of another bombing the day before, which targeted Ms. Milani's mother and killed a bystander at a bus station in Fiji's capital, Suva. Ms. Milani's brother, Benedito, now a police officer in Australia, has told detectives he saw the incident unfold when he was 13 years old. In a police statement, he describes a deafening roar as the bomb exploded, then seeing a male bystander with blood pouring out of his stomach. Veronica Milani has declined to speak for legal reasons, but her husband Manoa says the ordeal has caused considerable stress to the family.
It really has emotionally affected us, particularly when the memories has been replayed into our minds and into Veronica's mind and how it has affected my two sons.
This week, the Attorney General Ayaz Sayed Kayum gave a statement to police regarding the allegations but has not responded to the ABC's detailed questions about the matter. Dr. Stephen Rotuva is a political sociologist at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. He says there is merit in the calls for Mr. Syed Kaim to stand down.
In this kind of situation, it's probably the fairest thing to do for him to do that so that the investigation can go through as independently and as fairly as possible, particularly because the Attorney General is quite powerful within political and judicial system in Fiji. So it's important that he should move aside and make sure that the investigation continues.
Police have already sent a brief of evidence on the case to the Director of Public Prosecutions to decide whether charges should be laid. He sent it back asking for further investigations. Charges have not been laid and the allegations are yet to be tested in court. In his role as Attorney General, Ayaz Syed Kaim is consulted to help appoint Fiji's DPP. A spokeswoman for the DPP says he has full independence and doesn't report to the Attorney General on any matters or decisions. She declined to comment further while police are still investigating the case. The ABC is not suggesting there's been any interference, but people like Dr. Stephen Rotuva say there does need to be transparency.
There has to be impartiality in the process. There has to be transparency in the process. There has to be a sense of justice and devoid of potential interference. So I'm not saying that there would be interference, but perception of interference and perception of independence. And I think it's important that he needs to step down as well, as others have been saying, just to be fair on the process.
Despite the story being flashed on the front page of one of Fiji's leading newspapers several days this week, there's been silence from the Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama. One of Fiji's former PMs, Mahendra Chowdhury, says that's not good enough.
But I think there should also be a statement from the Prime Minister's office, because a senior minister of his government is under police investigation. Now, what is his position on this? Has he asked the minister to step aside, or is he going to do anything about it or not? But I think there is a need for him to issue a statement on the matter.
Political expert John Frankel is also watching for signs of tension between the Prime Minister and his so-called power broker, Ayaz Syed Kaim.
Clearly, if he stood down from his role, that would be a sign of diminished or withdrawn support from Bainimarama, which we'll have to wait and see whether we've got to that stage at this point.
Dr. Frankel says the events could also expose friction between the Attorney General and Fiji's military leaders.
Military officers have been at the head of the police force most of this period. And that, of course, creates an interesting dynamic as regards the relationship with the Attorney General, because it's well known that the top brass in the military are not supportive of the Attorney General. And at times, that tension between the top brass in the military and the Attorney General has threatened to come out in public, but it hasn't. It's been kept behind closed doors. So we'll see what happens in that respect. That's certainly a tension point to watch.
And he says public support for Ayaz Syed Kaim has declined in recent years.
They certainly have lost a considerable degree of popularity over the last few years. Even at the last election in 2018, you could see a significant slippage of their indigenous Fijian support. And the indigenous Fijians are now a majority in the country. So a lot of people in Fiji see the writing on the wall for the government at the next election scheduled in 2022. So this could be an interesting moment along that road.
The Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, has not responded to the ABC's questions. Now, almost 5 months since Veronica Milani lodged her complaint against Ayaz Syed Kaim, her husband Manoa is calling for a swift resolution.
The image to the country, is the message that event portrays, is saying that Fiji is not really portraying a democratic country, and it's unacceptable.
Manoa Milani ending that report by Marion Farr, which was produced with Michael Walsh.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. There are concerns that a new free trade deal between tiny Pacific nations and Australia and New Zealand, which will reduce tariffs on a range of products, including tobacco and processed foods, will exacerbate the region's non-communicable disease crisis. As we've reported on Pacific Beat before, the long-awaited PACER Plus is set to come into effect in a little over 3 weeks' time, and it's meant to create jobs, lift living standards, and boost economic growth. Not everyone is on board, though. Fiji and PNG have refused to sign on to the deal, while only 8 small Pacific nations have so far ratified it, along with Australia and New Zealand. Here's reporter Marla Damati with the latest in our special PACER Plus series.
The Pacific is currently battling an NCD crisis. Non-communicable diseases like diabetes, heart disease and cancer are the region's biggest killers. The WHO says they're responsible for 75% of deaths. It's something that's very personal for Tonga's Health Minister, Dr. Amelia Afuha'amangu Tuipulotu.
I used to be very healthy before when I went to school in Australia. I was a gymnastic and I used to go to the gym and I come back to Tonga, got married and put on huge amount of weight.
She says while everyone should take responsibility for their own actions, she believes the only way to tackle the NCD crisis is to do it as a community.
A person has a personal responsibility to do something about their own health and their own well-being going forward. But of course, a person or a community will not be able to flourish unless there is a supporting systems and supporting layers within the community. So we are looking into promoting a new NCD strategy in one of our remote islands as a pilot work. And that is something that I'm very interested in. And what I am advocating for is for us health professionals to be courageous and take the lead. We will need to make radical and major changes to our lives and our lifestyle, our food and our activity in order for us to be best model to our population.
The Pacific's current NCD crisis is blamed largely on unhealthy imported foods that are generally cheaper and more convenient than homegrown and cooked produce. There are some fears the new Pacer Plus free trade deal might just make things worse.
The concern for those of us in public health would be that the undesirable, unhealthy goods would get freely imported into the islands. And I refer in particular to highly processed fatty, salty, sugared, highly processed food, and indeed sugared soft drinks.
Dr. Colin Tukuitonga is one of the Pacific's leading public health experts, now an associate professor at the University of Auckland. He's worried by one of the trade deal's key features. That means the selection of Australian and New Zealand exports to the Pacific will have their tariffs reduced, making them cheaper to buy.
And most islands, many islands, half of what they already eat are imported, highly processed food items. And if you have a trade agreement that facilitates even freer movement of those goods, then one would imagine it'll aggravate a problem that's already at crisis point.
The tariffs won't be removed immediately, and their rates will differ from country to country, but the plan is that almost 90% of Australian and Pacific exports to the region will eventually have zero tariffs within the next 30 years. That will include a range of ultra-processed food, alcohol and tobacco, which are all linked to NCDs. For example, there'll be no tariffs on cigarettes in Cook Islands within just 3 years. But Samoa isn't removing its tobacco tariffs, which remain at 35% despite the deal. Concerns about tobacco tariffs have been raised during Pacer Plus negotiations by a range of organisations. The Australian Public Health Association had described it as unconscionable for Australia to support the reduction of tariffs on tobacco products. And people like Dr. Patricia Ranald, who is the convener at the Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network, are worried the deal will make unhealthy foods more appealing.
When you reduce tariffs on imported and highly processed foods and make them cheaper and more available in small farming and fishing island economies, it can have an impact on health. Again, there have been public health studies which show that what tends to happen is that people's diets change and they rely more on these cheap imported processed foods rather than locally produced food, which is actually less processed, less fatty, less sugar, etc. So that's a possible impact on health.
But supporters of the PACER Plus deal do point to parts of the agreement they argue will support public health measures in the Pacific, such as reduced tariffs on things like personal protection equipment, medicines, and even medical equipment. And despite his concerns, Dr. Tukui Tonga says that there are opportunities outside of PACER Plus which can help ensure Australia and New Zealand support the Pacific's public health systems.
So I would expect, particularly Australia and New Zealand, to highlight the issue of public health, not just encouraging free trade. And certainly in the islands, I would encourage them to ensure that the public health dimensions are lifted and highlighted.
That was Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga, one of the Pacific's leading public health experts, now an associate professor at the University of Auckland, ending that report from Mala Damati.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a two-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia across the Pacific.
Let's have some of our own music now on Pacific Beat. This is Glass Animals with Heat Waves.
You look so broken when you cry. One more and then I say goodbye. Sometimes all I think about is you. Late nights in the middle of June. Heat waves been faking me out. Can't make you happy or not. Sometimes all I think about is you. Late nights in the middle of June. Been faking me out. Can't make you happy now. I just wonder what you're dreaming of when you sleep and smile so comfortable. I just wish that I could give you that look that's perfectly unsaid. Sometimes all I think about is you. Late nights in the middle of June. He always been faking me out. He always been faking me out.
Glass Animals there with one of their new songs, that was Heatwave. Now it's time to find out all the latest weather news, and to do that I'm joined by Neville Coop from Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Jordan.
Neville, it seems like there's quite a bit of rain across the Pacific region. Let's start with Fiji. What's going on there?
Yeah, look, we have a weak front that's just to the southwest of us. It's formed out of a band of cloud that was left over from the South Pacific Convergence Zone, which was quite active earlier in the week, but has since dissipated. So we've got a little low sitting just to the east of New Caledonia, just to the south of Vanuatu. So quite a long way from Fiji, but there is a front that's forming along that, associated with that low that's forming along the old South Pacific Convergence Zone, and that's going to bring some showers and perhaps a few thunderstorms again to Fiji, especially the southern and eastern parts today.
And elsewhere across the Pacific, I see Tuvalu also might have some showers?
Yeah, look, they places up near the equator have really been suffering since the onset of the La Nina conditions back in the early part of spring. So they've had 2 or 3 months of very dry weather. This is countries like Kiribati, Tuvalu, Nauru, also the Tokelau Islands. And that's to be expected during a La Nina, and that's what we would expect to see. So fortunately for folks in Tuvalu, they're getting a bit of rain today, which will do some good. It'll help, excuse me, a bit of a frog in my throat this morning. It'll help to fill some rainwater tanks, and it will also give a bit of surface water for folks that have gardens, etc. So lucky ones in Tuvalu, but it's still very dry, especially around Kiribati and Nauru at this stage, and that's going to continue into the new year.
And this rain that's happening just across the Pacific today with across all those regions, will that be heading into the weekend as well? Will people get a cool change from that across the weekend?
No, unfortunately, we're done with cool changes in our part of the world now. The next time we'll see any cool weather, I tell people whenever they ask me, which is pretty much all the time, is about April. So we've only got two types of weather now, the hot and humid and the really hot and really humid. So it's going to stay pretty steamy right through the weekend. The cloud helps to keep temperatures a little milder, of course. If it's bright sunshine, it gets a lot hotter and the humidity becomes quite insufferable for many. But certainly right now in those countries to the north around PNG and the Solomons, it's pretty steamy. And so it's going to stay much like it is today across the weekend, wherever you are, I would think.
Well, hopefully some people can find some cool relief amidst all that hot humidity. Neville Croupe, thank you so much for those updates.
You're welcome, Jordan.
That was Neville Croupe, the director of Nandraki Weather, bringing us those weather updates from across the region. And if you want to see across it, across the weekend, you can just head to Facebook and type in Nandraki Weather. Now time to find out all the latest news updates from across the region, and I'm joined by Catherine Grau. Catherine, let's start in PNG because there's been a lot going on this week. Have we got any more answers on what is set to happen with Parliament, but also on the COVID-19 cases amongst the MPs?
Look, we have quite a few different developments. So let's start with Parliament, Jordan, because that's actually, though I should say, playing out in the country's Supreme Court in three different cases, all arguing different points. But in a nutshell, because it is quite complicated, I won't go into the details. But one of the cases sees the opposition taking the matter to court, arguing that last week's session of Parliament, in which the budget was passed while opposition MPs weren't actually in the House, they're arguing that that was illegal, and the opposition actually wants to have Parliament sit on December the 1st, that is next Tuesday, when we expect that they will be wanting to push ahead with their plans for a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, James Marape. They will, though, need the court to rule in their favour because the Parliament session was actually adjourned all the way till April, also last week. And the court's being asked, obviously, to decide on this. But it actually, this week, tried to ask the opposition and the government parties to come up with an agreement themselves. But as our PNG correspondent, Nashley Whiting, who's back in Port Moresby, reported, as expected, the two sides did not agree on whether they should adjourn or stay Parliament. And so the Supreme Court matter will now come back again on Monday when we expect perhaps a decision. As I said, though, there are actually two other cases as well going on. We could get a decision on one of them possibly today, and that is about whether the election of Prime Minister James Marape as PM all the way back last year was actually valid. So lots going on. Now, Pilar Nyiningi, who is the new Attorney General, spoke about all of this after court yesterday, and he was emphasising, Jordan, that they need to carry on doing the right thing, whatever the courts say. Let's have a listen.
I wanted to appeal to Papua New Guineans that we must allow the rule of law to take its normal course. So whatever happens on Monday, we will proceed from there. And so far, I want to thank the people of Papua New Guinea for observing the rule of law and doing the right thing. We must carry on doing the right thing. Let the court make its own decision or findings.
It's really emphasising doing the right thing. But some people, Jordan, are actually questioning if MPs themselves are doing the right thing when it comes to COVID-19. Because as we've reported this week, at least three MPs have tested positive to COVID-19. They were said to have been at the Loluwata camp as part of this political toing and froing. There's a group of government MPs who've been staying at a resort called Loluwata outside of the capital, Port Moresby. Now, speaking with a crowd of reporters all around him yesterday outside of court, he had no mask on. Pilar Nyiningi actually revealed this.
We are very, very concerned. As such, we've called the doctors to each camp to go and visit them and do the normal tests. So I've gone through the test and I've not got the result yet. You never know.
So he's confirmed there that he's had a COVID-19 test, but he's waiting for the results. He's not in isolation at the moment. And as we know across the world, the health advice has been that if you've been identified as a close contact of someone with COVID-19, you then get tested, you need to self-isolate while you wait for the results. So he's not doing that. And it actually appears, Jordan, that others who were also close contacts, including the Prime Minister James Marape, also look like they're breaching those sorts of recommendations. James Marape was in public yesterday. He, though, I must say, was wearing a mask, but he had this to say.
Based on instruction from a national control command centre, under the controller's instruction, that we all undergo tests. I think all have gone through tests, and I will be doing my tests, if not later today, tomorrow. So it's part of the normal protocol. You know, when the controller issues a test for us, you know, we all not superhuman being. We have to undergo a test like everybody else.
Of course, yes, you've got to undergo a test, but you should also be in isolation until you are tested, just in case you have COVID-19 and could be spreading it, is the official health advice. And it's not just in PNG where questions are now being asked about leaders who people want to be leading by example. We saw, of course, a furor here in Australia this week when news came out that the New South Wales Premier had been holding meetings with people face-to-face for up to 2 hours after she herself had had a rapid COVID-19 test, and she was waiting for the results, which did come back pretty quickly, and they were negative and lucky in that case. So certainly lots to unpack here, Jordan, and I think we'll certainly see much more to develop as well on this.
Definitely. And as you say, must be very frustrating for people in Papua New Guinea watching their leaders have to go through all these protocols, but then not adhere to them as they tell the public to do. So something we'll keep across here on Pacific Beat that we'll be watching. Now, Catherine, we've heard a lot about Pacific workers coming here to Australia despite closed borders, but over the ditch in New Zealand, they're needed as well.
Yeah, that's right, although it appears that it's a little less pressing for them to have workers come so soon due to their weather. Their harvest seasons generally start a little later than here in Australia. But they do say that they need about 14,000 workers every year. There are 6,000 or so Pacific Islanders who are still in New Zealand because they couldn't get home earlier this year. But Radio New Zealand International and a few others this morning are reporting that the New Zealand government has today announced that it's going to allow and help the industry bring in another 2,000 workers from the Pacific. It's going to impose those strict conditions, as you'd expect. They will be certain wages set, and also quarantine costs are going to have to be paid by employers. And the workers, in fact, would actually be paid while they're in quarantine for at least 30 hours a week. As is the case here in Australia, there's limited capacity in these quarantine facilities, so they are going to have to stagger the entry of workers coming in and coming in groups. We are hearing in these reports that the recruits are going to come from island nations in the Pacific, but the government's not yet specified which countries are going to be chosen. They'd stay in New Zealand for the picking season, and then they've got to work out if workers stay or if they would head home. So it's likely they'll be arriving in around January or between January and March next year. But at the same time, Jordan, I should just note that like we're seeing here in Australia, the governments are also trying to convince local New Zealanders to be picking as well. They've also announced a new initiative today offering Kiwis $1,000 incentive to get them out picking work so that they obviously try and fill that shortfall that they're facing.
And finally, Catherine, there are plans for a Chinese fishing plant in PNG's far southwest corner, but it's apparently causing concern for Australia's fishing industry as well.
That's right. This story is being reported by The Guardian newspaper today. It's reported that there are plans for a $200 million Chinese-built fishery plant on Daru Island in PNG's western province. Now, it was announced by China's Ministry of Commerce earlier this month. It's a memorandum of understanding that's been signed between China with PNG officials, including the fishing minister and the local governor for western province. And the idea is that this would be a hub for fishing vessels who are coming into the region in the Torres Strait part between Australia and Papua New Guinea, and they'd be able to process their catches that are taken in that area. But the local member in Queensland, Warren Ench, has said that it's going to impact their side of the fishery if it actually happens, but he's actually more worried about the treaty villages of PNG who live in this region and have a special deal where they are allowed to fish in the waters. He's worried about them. There's also concerns from others in the industry about the fact that this could see an increase in illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing. But PNG is certainly talking up the benefits of it. The minister says it'll bring jobs and help promote economic development in a part of PNG that is certainly underdeveloped. As I mentioned, this is only an MOU, just a memorandum of understanding at this stage, but certainly getting a bit of criticism for the moment. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
Definitely. Catherine, thanks so much for bringing us those updates.
My pleasure.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +61437519385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +61437519385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Fiji's Registrar of Political Parties has cleared the governing Fiji First Party of any potential breaches of the law over the donation it has received. Last month, we reported on the list Fiji First had submitted to the Registrar detailing the donations it said it had received between 2014 and 2019. Among them were several donations from people who had the same names as people who held senior positions in government-owned corporations or statutory bodies. There were also two donations made by people with unusually similar names, which potentially breached the maximum limit for donations to political parties. But the Registrar, Mohamed Sanim, said he's verified the list and everything is in order. Liam Fox has been following the story. First, Liam, take us back and remind us what you found when you had a first look into Fiji First's donation list.
Well, our colleague Kelvin Anthony took a long look at the list and found donations from 19 individuals who have the same names as people who held senior positions with government-owned corporations or statutory bodies between 2014 and 2019. We're talking about organisations like Fiji Airways and Energy Fiji, the country's largest superannuation fund, Post Fiji, the Fiji Sugar Corporation Board and the National Tourism Body. Now that's significant because the country's Political Parties Act says, quote, a public officer shall not engage in political activity that may compromise or be seen to compromise the political neutrality of that person's office, or publicly indicate support for or opposition to any political party or candidate in an election. So what is a public officer? Well, the Act also says a public officer is any person holding an office in or as a member of a statutory authority, a commission or a board established by or continued in existence by any law. Now, two other donations on the list also stood out, both made on September 11, 2014. The first is a 10,000 Fijian dollar payment by Dixon Peng, and the second is a $3,000 donation made by Dixom Peng. That's Dixom with an M. The names are very similar. If they were made by the same person, it would again breach the law because the maximum limit for political donations by an individual is $10,000 per year.
So, Liam, has the Registrar of Political Parties had to say?
Mohamed Sanim issued a statement this week which responded directly to the two issues we raised, that is, the payments by Dixon and Dixon Peng and the potential donations by public officers. Regarding the former, the statement said Mr. Sanim made inquiries with the party in relation to one person having donated over the $10,000 limit. The statement said the party clarified there was a typo error in the name and this has been noted in the publication of the lists. The registrar has also cited the receipt book record to verify the same. Now, regarding the second issue, the statement said Mr. Saneem made inquiries in relation to donations from persons who appear to be currently holding statutory board appointments to determine if there is a probable breach of law. The statement says, after verification, the registrar determined those donations did not constitute any breach of electoral law. In a few cases, other persons of the same name had made donations to the party. Now, the statement just raised more questions than it answered. What was the typo error? If there were only a few cases where people with the same name as public office holders made donations, what about the other cases? And exactly what verification did Mr. Saneem undertake? We put these questions to him via email. He did not respond directly to them and instead pointed us to the revised list of donations that was published in the Fiji Sun newspaper this week. This revised list did not include donations made in 2014, the year in which the donations by the two Mr. Pengs were made. Again, we asked Mr. Saneem why that was the case, but there's been no response.
Liam Fox there.
Hey, it's Rockin' Cav.
Love sport? Join Rockin' Cav every Thursday night across the Pacific.
Can you be more Pacific?
Each week, they'll have their own unique take on all things sport.
Our PNG sister, Elsie Albert. Wow, they call her the female jukebox because she just keeps delivering the hits.
Oh, my God. you like that?
Thursday nights across the Pacific.
People who go to Perth are probably at the end of their...
Wow, that's a big call.
Who goes there and just rips in?
Nick Natanui.
Nick Natanui's from Perth.
No, he's from Fiji.
Oh, my God.
Can you be more Pacific? 6 p.m. Thursday nights, PNG time.
Semirandrandra.
Killing it. Do you reckon he's got that Sonny Bill aura to him?
No. He's got a better aura.
Ooh!
Huh? That's that Fijian aura.
That's that Fijian aura.
I like that.
On Radio Australia.
That's what I'm talking about.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Here in Australia, the city of Melbourne is known as the cultural capital. Pre-COVID-19, the city's art and cultural scene was bustling, but it's now on life support after enduring one of the strictest lockdowns in the world during the coronavirus pandemic. But it's hoped a new art exhibition across Melbourne will revive it, including a massive mural of a local Indigenous Chamorro man from Guam that has been painted inside one of the city's most famous arcades. When Hila'an Pali'i heard that he was the subject of a painting in downtown Melbourne, he was blown away.
My brain just exploded. I was just like super, super stoked, you know, like, oh my God, like, this is insane. I could have never imagined that I'd be painted like a French girl.
That's because Mr. Pali'i is a jewellery carver and tattoo artist who lives more than 5,000 kilometres north of Melbourne in the US territory of Guam. The 5-metre-tall portrait has him looking off into the distance with his chest covered in traditional Chamorro necklaces. It's part of an installation by Australian artist Matt Adnate, who says he chose to paint Mr. Pali'i because of the rich Indigenous culture he represents.
I was lucky enough to travel to Guam about maybe 5 years ago now, for a mural festival over there, and spent a bit of time there hanging out with the local community and went to some pretty amazing sacred sites and got shown some pretty next level kind of places. And when I experience these elements and things like this, it completely, I don't know, like inspires me to keep doing what I'm doing. And obviously when I was there, I was photographing a lot of the Chamorro people, and there was a couple that I painted a lot. But yeah, ultimately, you know, there's a lot of different cultures that I work with around the world, but they've definitely been one of my favourite.
Matt Adnate is famous in Australia for his towering murals that depict highly realistic portraits of Indigenous Australians, which are often painted on the side of apartment buildings.
I do focus heavily on realism when I paint my portraits, and this is to provide as maximum kind of impact on the street. So when people see it, it has this real sense of presence, and the presence will then hopefully communicate to people, you know, certain emotions and, you know, different stories might reflect in their own person's understanding on who it might be.
The mural installation is part of a new art exhibition in Melbourne called Artcade, which has been set up to tempt Melburnians back into the city after a devastating year due to the pandemic. More than 700 coronavirus coronavirus cases were being reported each day at the city's peak in August, forcing the city and its people into a strict lockdown that kept most people at home and left many in the arts industry without work. And many independent artists haven't been eligible for government wage subsidies during COVID-19. For street artist Matt Adnate, whose art studio is the city's streets, Melbourne's lockdown restrictions meant he couldn't paint a single mural for 6 months, the first time he's been unable to do so in 20 years.
So I've always been painting outside, and, you know, whether it be my graffiti or my street art or portraiture, it's something that I absolutely love to do. And yeah, to miss that for 6 months is sort of, I mean, it was in a sense, there was a great silver lining in that it gave me time off to be with my family, and I've got a son and all that. But at the same time, it feels weird to not be able to do those things.
While Melbourne has managed to ease restrictions with no new cases since last month, Guam is still struggling with large numbers of COVID-19 cases. It's had restrictions in place to limit the spread of the virus, but in the past week alone, it's recorded more than 300 positive cases. But Hila'an Pali'i says that the restrictions like social distancing and recommended self-isolation haven't impacted his work that significantly.
Well, with the whole lockdown and stuff, that's already how I was leading my life before any of this happened, you know, working from home, pretty much keeping a tight circle with who I dedicate my time and energy to, you know, and most of my sales come from online anyway. So there's very little interaction with actual like people, you know. The only thing that this has really affected has been like public vending opportunities, festivals, marketplaces, stuff like that.
As an Indigenous Chamorro man, Hila'an is passionate about teaching others about his culture, and he hopes that once Guam has recovered from the virus, he'll be able to pursue his dream of learning more about traditional Chamorro tattooing.
I am trying to create a whole new style that resonates more deeply with Chamorro people and people from the region, because I noticed that a lot of the people here tend to take on more Polynesian tattoos as a way to identify with being from the islands. But I feel like being from this region of the world and have this region having its own distinct and very unique original tattoo style, people from this region should try to look deeper into that rather than reaching farther away to Polynesia. You know, they have their own continued unbroken tattoo history, whereas our tattoo history has been disrupted, you know, and so what I'm kind of trying to do is pick up where we left off.
Back in Melbourne, Matt Adnate says he hopes those who visit his mural will be able to reflect on the beauty of the world's many Indigenous cultures.
Ultimately, I would love people to be able to feel something from the artwork to reflect what their own story might be, you know, of this culture, and what their own understanding of who they might be, or somebody else might come along and see the images and get really sort of inspired and reflect on the beauty of those cultures and the real positive, incredible things that are about each and every one of those deep spiritual cultures.
Hila'an Pali'i shares that hope and wants his portrait to encourage people to celebrate Indigenous cultures, especially in places that have been colonized, like Guam and Australia.
The Indigenous people, we're becoming minorities in our own homeland, you know, and so it's becoming easier and easier for our voices to not be heard where they matter. More than anything, I want the Indigenous people of Australia to just know that they are alone in the world, because, I mean, at the end of the day, that's all I would really want for any other Indigenous people towards Chamorro people, you know, is just to be seen and heard and understood, and no one wants to be alone.
That was Hila'an Pali'i, a local jewellery and tattoo artist from Guam, speaking to me there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Scientists are racing to find and save wild bananas that are the living ancestors of modern-day cultivated bananas, and many still grow in the remote rainforests of Papua New Guinea and have genes capable of protecting one of the world's favourite fruits from climate change, pests and disease. Belgium-based scientist Sebastian Carpentier recently led an expedition to PNG to find these wild varieties before they're lost to deforestation and fires. He spoke with the ABC's John Daly.
PNG contains a very unique species that only occurs on the island of Papua. And it is one of the main ancestors of the commercial bananas we have now.
So what's the goal? What's the aim of this research?
Well, yeah, so the aim has two purposes. First of all, to show that we need to conserve wild habitats because they really contain unique diversity, right? And the second aim was indeed to try to make correlations between the microenvironment, we find a certain plant, an individual, and of course the genetic contents.
So what is the value of preserving these wild species or these wild varieties of bananas?
We know as scientists, we are also looking for gene hunting, right? So they contain unique genes. Since they are exposed to the natural threats, let's say, of the environment, that, like I said, only the fittest survives. That's completely different in agriculture, because you clearly pamper your plants and you protect them from all things that threaten and that would destroy your individual plants. The reason why we have our nice, delicious bananas is because farmers protect them, right? Mm. They would be quite vulnerable if you would leave them there and not take care of them. They would disappear and they would be taken over by other wild bananas for sure. So that's why the wild banana populations really contain unique combinations towards resilience towards the environment. And this is what we need. We need to, at least in my opinion, we need to stop putting heavy inputs in agriculture to protect our plants. Of course, you cannot avoid that, but at least we want to go to a way that we could reduce this, do agriculture in a more sustainable way in respect with the environment. So we need to stop growing one and the same unique banana variety in all environments. No, we need to see what is the local environment and what is the most suited variety for that environment, so that it's good for people, but it's also respecting. So we don't need too much inputs to keep it alive in that environment.
Right. So you're talking about finding resilient genes that can then improve commercial cultivation as we head into a future of climate change and more variability.
Exactly. So that's the idea, that we discover, that we understand why those wild varieties are pretty resilient towards the hostile environment that is around them. And of course, that we can put those individual wild plants as parents in breeding programs, so that we can step by step do crop improvement and make the best of two worlds, as a matter of speaking, having a very resilient plant and having a very big, delicious banana.
Speaking of delicious wild bananas, what were some of the weirdest varieties you saw out there in the jungles of Papua New Guinea?
So we were quite astonished to see one specific type of banana. It's Musa ingens. It only grows in the really highlands where it's not too warm. Really, it's the only banana that survives in full forest, so under the shade of the canopy, and it grows up to 15 meters tall. It was pretty amazing. I had never seen that. Also, the locals, they were not aware. They were aware that that the species existed, but many of the locals that guided us around had never seen them. So they're also quite endangered, since they can only thrive in really full, undisturbed forest.
And some wild varieties have hard seeds, which is, as someone who's spent their entire lives eating cultivated bananas, that sounds absolutely bizarre.
Exactly. So basically, people have been selecting bananas that were not only bigger and had contained more flesh, but also that had no seeds anymore. So normally a flower needs to be fertilized before it can set fruits. For some reason in the nature, banana acquired the trait to make a banana without being fertilized. And so if you're not fertilized, you don't contain seeds. And of course, humans notice those individuals in nature, and they're starting growing them and taking them, and because that's what they wanted, right? We all want bananas without seeds, because I can assure you, if you eat such a wild banana, there is nothing of flesh in there. It's only seeds. The seeds are hard. If you would swallow them, they are dangerous. They could like damage your stomach, your intestines, and so on and so on. So of course, people don't want seeds in their fruits. While other fruits, people are able to make through hormone treatments seedless fruits, banana does this from a natural way, and people have been selecting that. So that's very good. On the other hand, it's a disaster for breeding, because if you have sterile plants, you cannot use them anymore as parents, right? And so that's where you need to go back to the wild bananas for the breeding programs that are fertile, that have the seeds, so that you can make new crosses and create new varieties.
What's the risk if there isn't genetic diversity and you don't have those ancestors, the genetics of those ancestors stored and logged and accessible in the future.
Yeah, so indeed, there is a big risk, right? Of course, if forests disappear and you cannot go back to individuals that contain unique traits, of course, on the long term, you might lose a crop, right? Because the banana we have now is very, very vulnerable. It's being threatened by a lot of fungi on the leaf level and especially on the root level. Those fungi completely kill a crop. Like in the 70s, before the 70s, we were all eating another variety, Gros Michel. That was a fungus that arrived in Latin America. It was also called Panama disease. And basically, the whole commercial production has been wiped out. Because since this is what we call like a clone, every individual plant on the field has a unique, has the same genetic material. So they are clones from each other. And so if they are vulnerable for a certain disease or a certain condition, the whole field is wiped out. In contrast, what we want to go to is that a farmer has several banana plantations with several varieties. So in case something happens, his whole yield is not threatened. So you need to spread the risks by increasing the biodiversity on your fields.
Sebastian Carpentier, who is team leader of banana characterization and evaluation with the Alliance of Biodiversity International and the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture, and he was speaking there with John Daly.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
That's all for the program this morning, but Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Stay with us though on Radio Australia across the day and head over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can stay up to date with all the latest news and developments. We'll keep you up to date there with any breaking news. And on the Facebook page, you can also join in the conversation and have your say on all the stories from today, from the growing calls for Fiji's Attorney General to stand down from office to concerns that a new free trade deal between Pacific nations and Australia and New Zealand will exacerbate the region's non-communicable diseases. Thanks so much for your company this morning. I'm Jordan Fennell. Have a wonderful Friday.